That's it.
Adventures in technology. I taught my first hybrid retreat a couple months ago where some people were in person and some people were online, and that was a whole adventure. Well, welcome everybody. My name is Deborah. This is one of our few opportunities to actually gather all together in the hall. So we'll start by reciting the refuges and precepts, reaffirm our commitment to the practice, our commitment to our community. So feel free to join in if you like, or you can also just listen. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami, dhammam saranam gacchami, sangham saranam gacchami, dutiyampi buddham saranam gacchami, dutiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami, dutiyampi sangham saranam gacchami, tatiyampi buddham saranam gacchami, tatiyampi dhammam saranam gacchami, tatiyampi sangham saranam gacchami. Panatipata veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Adinadana veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Abrahmacharya veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Musawada veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Sura merya majapamadatana veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Then if you're on 8 precepts, wikala bhojana veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Nacha gita vadita visukadasana malaganda vilepana dharana mandana vibhusanatana veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Ucha sayana mahasayana veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. Idam me silam magapalanyanasa pachayo hotu. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So I had the idea during my time here this month at the Forest Refuge to talk a little bit about a commentary in the Theravada tradition called The Path of Purification, which some of you may have heard about, others maybe not. In Pali, it's called the Visuddhimagga. Visuddhimagga just means literally path of purification. Just to say a little bit about that name, that term purification can be one that for some of us is a bit triggering if we have come up or been associated with a spiritual tradition in which purification, you know, as a practice or a goal, was used in an unwholesome, in an unhealthy, in a negative way, in a harsh or judgmental way. That can be triggering for some of us. But nonetheless, that is the word that's used here in this text. But it's purification in the sense of, if we think about filtering water, right? If you have dirty water, it's got bacteria in it or microorganisms or just dirt or whatever, and you want to make it clean and healthy and wholesome, you've got to filter it. You've got to filter out all the gunk. So it's purification in that sense of filtering out what might make us sick, what might make us ill, you know, or in terms of our minds and our hearts, what's going to make us suffer. So it's purification of the heart, purification of the tendencies of the heart and mind that are what lead us to suffer, what cause us to suffer. So purification in a very wholesome, good way. And this text was written by a great monastic scholar called Buddhaghosa. Buddhaghosa. And he lived in the 5th century of the Common Era, so the 400s, about 1600 years ago, at a monastery called Mahavihara, which just literally means great monastery, one of the big monasteries in Sri Lanka. And this text is thought to kind of encapsulate the wisdom of that particular monastery, their tradition, their way of practice at that time in the 5th century. And it's a big book. It's a thick book, if you've ever sat down and tried to look at it, or if you come across it on the shelves here. I'm not sure if there's a copy in the library here. But you could spend an ox with it. That goes into a lot of detail. It's a very systematic, very comprehensive, very thorough description of their view of the Buddhist path at that time. And one of the first big commentaries of that type that was put into writing, kind of at the time, historically about 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha, when writing things down kind of first started to be a thing, where it became viable to actually keep written records, and for various social and political reasons, there was a desire to do that. So it's one of the oldest really complete commentaries on what people were doing in their practice, kind of in the, I guess you could call it the early centuries, even though it was already 1,000 years after the time of the Buddha. It's based on the Pali Canon, being the earliest records that are still existing from the Theravada tradition, the earliest school that's still existing of Buddhism. And it's based specifically on one sutta, one teaching from the Pali Canon, one early discourse attributed to the Buddha that talks about practice unfolding in 7 steps, 7 stages. That's called the teaching on the relay chariots, where the Buddha describes the path of practice as being like a relay race, you know, where you start off with one chariot, it goes a certain distance, and then they hand it off to the next one, I guess just the same way as we do relay races today, but in chariots. So starting from the very beginning of first stepping on the path, first hearing the teachings, all the way up to full enlightenment in 7 stages. And the Visuddhimagga takes that, you know, relatively brief teaching, most of those early teachings are pretty short, even the longer ones, and greatly expands on it, and it brings in all sorts of different elements, like things from the monastic discipline, things from many other suttas, things from the Abhidhamma, which was also itself kind of an intermediate step in trying to systematize and analyze and kind of put into order all the Buddha's teachings. And it's been a really significant influence on how meditation has been practiced in the Theravada school ever since, and in how we do it here, really. It's still the basis for how Buddhism is practiced in much of the Theravada world, and together with the Satipatthana Sutta, the Sutta, the teachings on the foundations of mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness, the Visuddhimagga and the Satipatthana, the path of purification and the foundations of mindfulness really form the basis, the foundation for this practice that we do here today. So the Visuddhimagga, as I said, is based on the Pali Canon, but it also has some innovations in it, which continue to be controversial, some of them, even after 1,500 years. So there are modern scholars and teachers who reject some of the ideas in the Visuddhimagga, and there are definitely points in it that could be debated. I'm not going to get into those so much here. But the fact remains that there's a lot in it that's really relevant to how we practice here today. So I want to talk specifically about some of what it has to say about insight and about how to practice for insight, about how insight arises, about what's meant by insight in the first place, in the hopes that it will be helpful in some way. So just as a little bit of an intro, the beginning part of the Visuddhimagga talks about the preparations for insight practice, the preparations for the arising of insight, mostly being threefold. So firstly, as we often talk about, is to kind of get our conduct in order. So there's a whole long section on the perfection of virtue, the purification of virtue, purification of conduct. And that comes up in the suttas as well over and over again. It's very clear that this was considered kind of the preliminary for launching into practice, for trying to cultivate concentration and wisdom, is that we needed to get our lives at least in some order, at least enough order that it doesn't torment us when we sit down on the cushion to look at our minds, at least enough order that we can sleep soundly at night. So kind of to get our lives in order, which, you know, I'm sure as everybody here knows, is a whole practice in and of itself, what goes on outside of the retreat center. And then to work on concentrating the mind, cultivating tranquility and concentration and focus of the mind through cultivation of deep states, a concentration called jhanas, which some of you have probably heard of, others maybe not. But there's a whole set of preparatory practices, which again are still practiced in many places in the world. Some of you may be doing them to train the mind and really cultivate qualities of mind that lead to stillness, to focus, to balance, to concentration, as a preparation for really being able to look at the mind, which even if we haven't cultivated or not particularly interested in cultivating jhana, formal jhana, or deep states of concentration, we see very quickly how it does take quite a bit of concentration to be able to sit down, look at the mind, be with the mind. So that's another step. And for a lot of us, that preparation happens here, happens when we arrive here, right? So we've come in out of our very busy lives, many of us. Some of us maybe are lucky enough our lives aren't so busy. But we've come here from whatever degree of activity and busyness there's been in our lives. And our first task when we get here is just to kind of arrive, right? To do that initial settling, just to get into the body, to get into the moment, to be able to just listen to the rain and really arrive before we can start to look and see what's happening in the present moment with some amount of clarity. And then the third preparation that the Visuddhimagga talks about is learning. It specifically says to learn and question about the core teachings. So it points out that we do need to do a certain amount of, you know, not getting PhDs, but we need to, you know, have contact with a teacher, we need to hear some talks. It goes through a whole list of kind of basic teachings that that we should have some clarity about, like the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, the Five Aggregates, lists that I'm sure you probably heard many times, that we need to have some grasp of at least the basic cognitive framework for doing this practice so that we can do it. We need our marching instructions. So getting our lives in order, calming and collecting the mind, getting enough information that we can do the practice. That's kind of the basic preparation. And from there, we can move on to the business of actually getting down to our meditation practice, our insight practice specifically, which the Visuddhimagga calls purification by insight. Purification by insight. So again, filtering out, clearing out all of the disruptive elements of mind, those unwholesome habits of heart. The first aspect of that being purification of view. This is said to be the first aspect of insight, purification of view. And it defines purification of view as being the correct seeing of mental and physical phenomena. The correct seeing of mental and physical phenomena. The correct seeing of mental and physical phenomena. So what is the correct seeing of mental and physical phenomena? Well, first just to say a word about mental and physical phenomena. This is what's often called, or what is called, nama-rupa in Pali, the term for mental and physical phenomena, nama-rupa. Nama, that word in Pali, is related to our word for name. We can think of it as mentality, as the realm of concept, so mental phenomena. And rupa literally means form. So, for example, when you talk about a statue like this, it's all, in Asia, it's called a Buddha rupa, a Buddha image or a Buddha form. So that's rupa, as materiality. So sometimes nama rupa is translated as name and form. You see that translation for it. Sometimes it's translated as mental and physical phenomena, mentality and materiality, those types of terms. I will often just call it nama rupa just because it's easier. Those other terms in English are kind of a mouthful. So nama rupa, mentality and materiality, mental and physical phenomena. So purification of view is the correct seeing of mental and physical phenomena, the correct seeing of nama rupa. So we can think of that as seeing what's actually happening now, seeing what's really happening now, seeing the real mental and physical phenomena that are actually happening in this moment. Which is really one of the luxuries and the pleasures and the part of the joy of being here, right? Being in a place like this. It's just so delightful to come to a place like this where there's nothing to do, there's nothing to accomplish, you know, there's nowhere we gotta be other than maybe here, or maybe not, even if we don't make it, doesn't really matter. That we just have this freedom and this luxury and this opportunity to just be in the moment. I mean, isn't it a relief to just be able to sit, listen to the rain? I love rainy days here. Just putter around, be in the body, you know, take our meals, do what we have to do, and just rest into that flow of the moment. So this is a big part of purification of view, or it's the starting point for purification of view, is just settling into the moment-to-moment experience, what's happening in the body, what's happening in the mind. So what is actually happening in this moment? It's kind of the big question. What is actually happening in this moment? We have a lot of ideas, right, about what's happening in this moment. We have a lot of concepts about what's happening in this moment. You know, here we are. Here I am. You know, at the forest refuge, doing my retreat, whatever my life circumstances are, whatever my history is, whatever I imagine my future might be. We've got a lot of ideas about what's happening now on many different levels, right? We come to see this. But what is actually happening now? What is actually happening in this moment? And there's many different schemes that are offered in the suttas, in the Pali Canon, for getting at that. There's a lot of different tools that the Buddha offers us and a lot that have been developed over the centuries and millennia for getting at that core question of what is actually happening right now. So a lot of the teachings, they deal with ways to deconstruct experience, to break it down into its components, break it down into different elements so that we can kind of get a grip of what is actually going on in this moment. Some of the most, some of the big ones, the big tools for this are the teaching on the six sense bases, talking about how what's happening in this moment is really only ever six things. Only ever six things that are happening in any moment. You know, either we're feeling something with the body, or we are feeling something with the body. We're seeing something with the eyes if they work. We're hearing something with the ears if they work. We're smelling something with the nose if it works. Tasting something with the tongue if it works. And we're cognizing something with the mind. That whole stream of things going through the mind is considered to be another sense organ, another stream of sense experience, but its own thing. So in any given moment, that's really all that's happening. That's all that ever happens. We're kind of six-dimensional creatures, very limited. Another one of the big schemes is the teaching on the five aggregates, which takes it from a little bit of a different perspective. Instead of considering all of those different physical phenomena separately, it just takes them all together. It says, okay, everything we feel with the body, plus all the sense organs, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, that's all materiality. That's all physical experience. And then it breaks down what's going on in the mind a little bit more into different categories. There's the whole realm of feeling, pleasure and pain, the whole pleasure-pain spectrum. There's the whole realm of perception, of recognizing, ideating. There's the whole realm of formations, mental formations, thoughts, emotions. And there's consciousness itself. So these are the kind of the two main ways that we find of breaking down experience, breaking it down into its component elements of what's actually happening right now. Those are the things that are actually happening right now. And that's really what we're here to get in touch with. And that's what our mindfulness practice is, one way or another, however we've been taught it, however we think about it for ourselves. That's what it really boils down to, is just connecting with what's actually really happening in this moment. The Visuddhimagga talks about using the four great elements to help us connect with the experience of the body, with the tactile sense. And I found this really helpful in my own practice. So what can we actually feel with the body? What actually happens in the body? That's not that much. It can feel very complicated. And we can get into all sorts of snits about what's going on with the body, especially as we get older. But even if when we're young, you know, here on retreat, the body gets up to all sorts of stuff. And we can have all sorts of ideas about what's going on in the body and what's happening, especially, I think, as modern people, because we have such a wealth of information, like anatomical and scientific information, compared to past generations, past eras. Although even in the Buddha's time, over in India there, they had a pretty sophisticated understanding of at least what the body was made up of. But in terms of what we can actually feel, you know, the felt body is an entirely different thing from the conceptual body that's made up of bones and muscles and skin and neurons and whatever else is in there. And that's a whole idea about what the body is. But when we actually sit and close the eyes and feel into the body, it's an entirely different thing, right? It doesn't have anything to do with any of that stuff. What we can feel is really according to the Visuddhimagga, and this can be interesting to check out if you haven't already, what we can actually feel is really only kind of three axes of types of sensation. So the first one that's often mentioned is the earth element. What kind of an ancient natural philosophy, kind of pre-science, was called the earth element, which in modern terms is basically just mass, what we call mass today, stuff, matter. That's one of the dimensions of the body that we can feel. So we can feel heaviness, right? Like just in this moment, just sitting here. You know, we're already starting to get quiet. Those of us that have just arrived, some of us are very quiet. And we can feel. You know, there's a certain weight, a certain sense of weight. And it might be different in different areas of the body. It might change even moment to moment. Certainly over the course of, you know, minutes or hours or days, it changes. So that's one dimension of what we can feel in the body. Heaviness, or, you know, it's opposite side of the coin, which is lightness. Heaviness and lightness, different areas of the body, different moments, has different quality. The second one being what is called the fire element, or the in modern terminology, temperature. We can feel temperature, right? This is the one that often gives us a lot of grief because we tend to perceive it as pain when it gets too hot or too cold. So this is the whole spectrum from burning hot to freezing cold, temperature. And again, in this moment, we can just check it out. We can feel that in the body. There's a certain temperature. You know, we feel warm, we feel cool. Different areas of the body, different temperatures. Cooler here, warmer there, maybe nothing in some areas, just kind of tepid in the middle. And then the last one that we can directly feel is what's called the air element, which is the whole dimension of movement, or lack thereof, which we might think of, I think of as kinetic energy, the kinetic energy component of what's going on in the body. So we can feel if there's vibration, we can feel if there's pulsation, we can feel if there's stiffness or pressure and a lack of movement, a resistance to movement. We can feel that movement of the breath, right? The breath is a manifestation of the air element coming and going, changing, moving in different ways, moving in different patterns. Any given moment, we can feel some combination of just movement, the natural movement of the systems of the body doing whatever they're doing. Even if we're sitting completely still, there's still movement. There's still the perception of movement in different places in the body, changing. So these are really the only three axes of experience in the body. This is what's really happening in the body. Very interesting to investigate. Very interesting to look at the body in this way if you haven't tried it out yet. It's only ever that, you know. We take that data, moments of temperature, moments of movement, moments of heaviness, changing. You know, we take that incoming stream of momentary sensations, and then we interpret it into everything that we know about the body, everything we think, everything we believe about the body. But ultimately, that's all that's really happening. That's it. That's the only game in town. Check it out. See, if you find something else in the body, let us know. I'd be really curious. There's a fourth element that's also mentioned in the suttas, the water element, and this is one point of differentiation between what you find in the Visuddhimagga and in the suttas, that the water element is said to be the element of cohesion. Like the analogy is given, if you take a bucket like of dust or fine dirt that's totally dry, right? It doesn't stick together, and then you add the water to it, and you can form it into a ball, you can form it into a mass and make it into a shape. So the water element is said to be like that, that we don't experience it directly. So it's not actually wetness. This is something I found really fascinating when I was checking out the elements. There's not actually any sensation that's wetness. So you can check that out too. There's nothing that actually feels wet. It feels some combination of the others, and then we interpret it as wet. But the water element is said to be that element that determines how coherent or how diffuse one of the other experiences is. So say we're having an experience of heat. It can either be very concentrated, which would be interpreted as having a lot of water element in it, or it can be like very diffuse, very suffused through the whole body, which would be interpreted as not having a lot of water element. So kind of like that. So heaviness can be very concentrated or more spread out. Heat can be very concentrated, more spread out. Movement can be very concentrated or more spread out. That's how the water element is interpreted. So that's the whole dimension of what's called the tactile sense, the feeling with the body. One of the things that really confused me when I first started working with the elements was the differentiation between feeling things externally and feeling things internally. So I used to go in and ask my teacher, like, when you talk about feeling the tactile sense, do you mean like touching things, you know, like what I feel when I touch things or things touch me, like the air on the skin or my, you know, my body on the cushion, that kind of thing? Or do you mean like the gurgling of my stomach and, you know, like the pain in my muscles and that kind of thing? And he'd be like, what are you talking about? And it's all the same thing, you know, which I got hung up on because I had such a, you know, my image of the body as having this inside and outside was so firmly entrenched, you know, like it was so plastered onto my physical experience. Like it took quite some time to let go of that and realize that was all just ideas. You know, it's all just moments of heaviness, moments of pressure, moments of heat, whatever it is. And there, when we look at the body as it actually is, experientially, the felt body, which is what we might call the real body, the body as it's actually experienced, there is no inside and outside, right? There is no separation. It's just this field of sensation. All of those ideas that separate, you know, the body out and separate, you know, what we consider us from our environment, those are all just concepts overlaid. What's really there? Heat, pressure, heaviness, movement, vibration. That's all there really is. So then we have the other kind of four physical senses, you know, the eyes, the ears, the nose, the tongue. And these can be really interesting to explore in the same way. So hearing, I'll talk about that one next because that one I feel like is also a little easier to get. Hearing is a two-dimensional experience. So in hearing, if we pay attention, what is actually the experience of taking in that data at the ears? It's only got two variables. It's got pitch. Now, is it high sound or is it low sound? Or is it somewhere in between? It's got pitch and it's got volume. Is it loud? Is it soft? You know, that's all that happens with hearing. That's all that happens with hearing. Pay attention. It's really interesting if you haven't checked it out before. Everything else is concept. Everything else is interpretation. You know, it can be really fascinating to find that place where we can just really take in what's coming in the ears. You know, it gets louder, it gets softer, it gets higher, it gets lower. You know, maybe there's different strands of different things doing different stuff. You know, many of us have probably had that experience of, you know, sitting and that flow of information coming through the ears. It just becomes like a symphony, right? All the concept around what we're hearing loosens up a little bit, and we can just be in that flow of, oh, it's just sound that's coming and going. That loud breathing, you know, next to us, or that, you know, lawnmower going out in the yard or whatever it was that was causing us so much distress. Just sound. Just louder and softer, higher and lower. That's it. And the other senses are analogous to that. You know, I won't go through them all in detail, but, you know, the eye, you know, seeing can be kind of one of the last bastions of really getting what's actually happening for those of us that have eyes that work, because we tend to be so dependent on them, right? As human beings, we really rely on what's seen. So the concept is really heavy in seeing. It's so hard to look out at a visual field and not get caught up in all the concept of what we're seeing, to just see color and light. Color and light are really like the two dimensions of seeing. You know, where does it fall on that range of the ultraviolet spectrum that we can see, and how bright is it? You know, is it dim or is it bright? So you could check that one out too. But it can be hard for that one to not get totally overlaid by the concepts. And tongue and nose are a little more subtle. Like even in modern science, like we still don't really understand what the tongue and the nose are doing, right? Like I think the sense of smell is one that modern science still just can't even really explain, although we're getting closer. But we can check those out in the same way. So that's what's going on in the body. That's it. Really. That's materiality. That is the sum total of our material physical experience as human beings. There's really nothing else available to us. Other types of beings, they have access to other senses. Some of them are kind of wacky, but we don't. You know, we get the tactile sense, you know, the tactile sensitive body, seeing, hearing, smelling, and tasting. So then we also have the whole mental realm. And what is going on in the mind? The mind often seems so complicated, especially compared to the body. The body seems complicated enough. The mind even more complicated. But the Visuddhimagga points us towards the four mental aggregates that show up in that list of the five aggregates. So first and foremost, feeling. It's called Vedana, which is the pleasure-pain spectrum, which is this other whole dimension of our experience. Going back to the body a little bit, the thing about each of the five physical senses is they're completely independent. That's one thing I forgot to mention. So like seeing is not hearing, right? These tend to get all mixed up through concept too. So we look out the window, we see a bird, we hear the bird chirp, right? In our mind, concept mushes those two together. Right? It's the bird chirping, it's the bird we see, and it puts them both together. But when we actually pay attention, you know, to what's the actual real experience, the hearing is one thing, the seeing is something totally different. Right? Seeing an image doesn't happen in the hearing realm, and hearing the song doesn't happen in the seeing realm. They're, like in scientific terms, we call them orthogonal. they don't overlap. They're completely different spheres. And it's the same with the mind. So we see this when we pay attention, is that the mental sphere is completely different from the physical sphere. You know, thoughts don't happen in the body, heat doesn't happen in the mind. Each of those spheres, the mental sphere and the physical sphere, they have their own unique set of experiences and they don't overlap. Each has their own particular quality, their own particular texture. So there's the pleasure-pain spectrum, which is always going. Like this is another really interesting aspect of experience to check out. We don't really just rest in that. Like every moment, there's some perception of things being painful, pleasant, or somewhere in between. You know, it's a whole spectrum. And at every given moment, the mind, kind of the ancient reptilian mind, is feeding us that information. Do I feel good? Do I feel bad? Do I feel somewhere in between? Where on that spectrum do I fall? Then there's the whole realm of perception. Which perception is a really interesting one. Faculty of mind that recognizes. It's kind of like the first layer of cognizing or ideation is kind of a heady word, but I find that's a good word for it. It's like that first level of just kind of recognizing, oh, I know what that is. You know, this falls into that category. This is like this. So it's kind of that really nuts and bolts level of conceptualization before we get to full-blown thought. Is perception, that recognition, identification of things. And then from there we move on to what's called mental formations, which is kind of like the full-blown thoughts, the full-blown emotions, kind of the fully formed mental constructions. And then consciousness itself. So this isn't the only way of analyzing what's going on in the mind, but it's a fairly straightforward and comprehensive one. It kind of covers all the bases. Everything that the mind can do falls within one of those, kind of like with the body and the three elements. You know, everything that the body can experience falls within those three elements. Everything that the mind can do falls within these four conceptual mental aggregates. And, you know, we may have, you guys may have worked with various ones of these over the course of your practice. I know I've kind of moved around between them, these frameworks and other frameworks, depending on what was most useful at the time. So when I first started my practice, I worked a lot with seeing things through the lens of the six sense spheres. because it focuses more on the physical domain, which was more obvious to me when I first started my practice, right? It was as much as I could do just to kind of tease out the different sense doors, you know, between seeing and hearing and, like I was saying, what's going on in the body, the tactile sense, let alone trying to see more clearly different things going on in the mind. So I tended to use that framework of seeing things through the five physical senses, and then everything else going on in the mind is just kind of like, okay, that's the mind, that's everything else, that's mental. If I could just identify that something was a mental experience, I felt like I was ahead of the game. But then as I got a little deeper into my practice and I could see more detail, then that's when that exploration of the four elements started to become richer and more informative, and I started to use that framework a lot. And then more recently, the last few years, actually, the aggregates have become more useful to me as I've started to see more detail and more nuance of what's going on in the mind, and actually being able to tune more into subtle aspects like of consciousness and perception. So the Buddha offered us this wealth of different ways of kind of breaking down and relating to, understanding what's really happening in this moment. And we can check it out for ourselves, you know, we can pick and choose and see which of those frameworks, if any of them, or our own that we come up with, is most useful. You know, the one way that this practice is described is that we're all kind of composing our own Abhidhamma. We're all kind of, you know, there's all these teachings that have come to us, but in the end, we're all sitting down, exploring this fathom-long body and seeing, okay, what is in there? You know, what does the body really feel like? What does the mind really get up to? And figuring out that for ourselves, which may be in some good alignment with one of these classical frameworks, or maybe slightly different, depending on what we find. You know, what matters ultimately is not what the teachings say, but what the truth is. Because the truth is what's going to set us free. So I think I will end there with this for tonight, and I'll carry on with this in my next talk. So we'll close with sharing the merit, sharing the benefits of our practice. If you'd like to join in. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing. May all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.